And we welcome everybody into another installment. It is College Football Forever, and College Football Forever really begins in a week and a half. Forever from that point on, for week zero, which I think will be the new week one, Brad. And we've got a lot of things to talk about as we actually have practices. We have, unfortunately, injuries coming out of practices. But we it's more tangible now this time of year in mid-August than it is in the dog days of summer. Brad Crawford of CBS does a great job. I don't think we've had you on this particular show, which is crazy. And the last time you and I spoke, we were doing something for TV together, I think about a year ago, previewing the season. So it's great to have you on. Josh Pate, now of ESPN, who we've had on a number of times before, will join us at around 9:30 or so. And we'll just kind of chop it up, Brad, because we actually have things to chop up now. Not games yet, but polls are out, stories are out, and everything else. Good morning to you and welcome.
Yeah, it's good to see you again, Mike. And yeah, man, last time we spoke, we were on CBS HQ together previewing last season, I think it was. And now Here we are, 2026. Finally, we're done talking about CFP expansion and further conference changes and Congress getting involved in college football. I'm just glad it's back to X's and O's, fall camp, injury reports, scrimmage, inside intel. I'm very excited for the season, and I'm happy that week zero now is about 1.5 weekends away.
Are you like me? Do you think sooner rather than later that that's going to be the new week one as we kind of adjust this calendar?
I think it will. And, you know, you're going to have more marquee games in week zero. Actually, I mean, there's some decent week zero games. This is the best week zero slate I think we've seen in three or four seasons. NC State, Virginia, open ACC play, and then you've got TCU, UNC from Dublin. So there's some games that I'm anticipating next weekend.
Yeah, they're respectable. Virginia was one of the great stories last year, really, in the country, certainly out of the ACC. Coach Elliott finally had it going. It took a little bit. I think they're a little more patient there in Charlottesville than some of the other jobs that are out there where you're firing coaches now in 2 years in some cases. But I'll be curious to see what the follow-up there is for the Cavaliers. NC State, we kind of know what they're going to do. They're one of the most predictable 7-8 win teams every season, it feels like, under Dave Doran.
Yeah, they've, you know, pretty much averaged that the last 10 plus years under Doran. I do think his seat is warming a little bit. You know, they've spent so much money to retain CJ Bailey that they wound up losing several offensive starters because they had to allot so much money toward that quarterback. But NC State's schedule, I went through them earlier this summer for CBS. It is the easiest schedule in Power Four for, you know, one of those borderline top 25 teams. So if NC State gets past that opening game at Virginia, I do think there's a good chance that despite not being the most talented team in the conference, there's a path to 9 or 10 wins, which would get Dave Doran a couple more years in Raleigh.
It's interesting you say that. We were just talking about this on one of our other programs yesterday at the ACC. Like, I never felt more confident that one team is going to win that league, especially when the one team has never won that conference. Talking about Miami, they joined in 04. They haven't in 22 years won the ACC, which is mind-boggling. And yet they just seem such an easy pick to win that league, but I have no idea who's going to finish second or third.
Miami's my preseason number one. I don't see the holes that a lot of other national analysts do in the Hurricanes. You talk to anybody close to that program, they're saying the same things they did this time last year, that we're going to be a conference champion contender and a CFP top four seed. And Miami got through the playoff last year, got to the Natty. But getting to your question about the teams behind them, I think it's SMU and Louisville. The winner of that week two game against, you know, SMU and Louisville, I think winds up playing Miami for a final. I know NC State schedule's easy, but SMU and Louisville, SMU quarterback Kevin Jennings, multi-year starter, Louisville re-up in the transfer portal, re-sign Isaac Brown at running back, probably a 1,000-yard rusher. So I do think that there's multiple playoff contenders from the ACC outside of the Canes.
It's interesting you say that, because the one team you didn't mention, and it's the first time in a long time they were not preseason top 25, is Clemson. Yeah. You agree or disagree with that?
I had Clemson number 24 in my preseason rankings because I'm still of the belief that an 8-4, 9-3 finish, despite not getting to the final, gets him in the top 25. This is like Dabo Swinney's last hurrah, too, man. I mean, his back is figuratively, I mean, it's against the wall in Death Valley. I think he knows that. Clemson's not going to fire him, obviously, but he's wearing thin there, and, you know, he has his horse tied to Vezina. We'll see him at quarterback. And then bringing Chad Morris back, it's one of the more head-scratching coaching decisions this offseason to bring a guy that has not had an explosive offense in college in a long time, you know, since Taj Boyd. So I think it'll be very interesting in Death Valley to see if Clemson can get off on the right foot against LSU, and then they play Miami several weeks later. We'll know early in September, Mike, if Clemson's worth a don or not.
I think they're a fascinating story. The headline, obviously, if you're going to get headlines from a preseason poll, and let's be honest, as much as people want to bang the poll, everybody looks at it.
Of course.
You're not a college football fan if you just ignore it completely. You might disagree with it, and you might be, I don't want to say paranoid, but overly worried that like that preseason poll is going to shape the playoff poll. That was the argument for years and years. I think we're getting away from that. I mean, even last year in the playoff poll, it took the committee a long time to do it. But the final week, they said, oh, yeah, Miami did beat Notre Dame head to head. Let's leapfrog them over Notre Dame, even though Notre Dame didn't do anything to get penalized. I think for the most part, the polls are harmless now. You might even say irrelevant once the season starts, and certainly once the playoff poll comes out, and we'll have to wait a while for that, then nobody even looks at the AP or the coaches poll. It's like they don't even exist anymore, right? They're just in a vacuum of irrelevance at that point.
Yeah, it's preseason fodder. It sort of shapes the early September narrative. We're going to know 3 or 4 weeks into the season if these top 10 teams are legitimately the 10 best teams in college football. 18 of the last 19 seasons in the AP poll, we've had a team not ranked in mid-August finish inside the top 10. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, our job this time of year is to look at these narrative setting polls and rankings and figure out who's overrated, who's underrated, who's not ranked right now that could be at season's end. And I think schedule favorability and your roster talent-wise in the two deep, those are the two main factors to me. Coaching, yes, has a lot to do with it, but schedule favorability, man, it means a lot in college football.
I don't disagree with your Miami pick, by the way. I mean, if I filled out a poll, I don't think I'd have them number one, but I wouldn't argue against them. My only question, and they've done such a good job at two things in the portal recently. Number one, they keep nailing, if not the most highly coveted portal quarterback, right there in the top three. And they've always, since the portal, in this era, they've always been able to get linemen in the trenches, grown, you know what, men that already know how to either block and tackle. Last year, just nobody was better. I saw them up close against Florida State. Nobody was better on the line of scrimmage. I knew that much watching that game. And then I thought to myself, you know, Carson Beck, if he doesn't screw it up, Carson Beck is a good passer who's probably going to be on an NFL roster for a while, as long as he doesn't have a late second blip, which he did in the national championship game. But they look the part every year because they have the quarterback and they have the line of scrimmage. Honestly, I don't know how good the line of scrimmage is this year compared to last year, where they were just, like I said, as good as anybody. What do you make of it this year?
On the defensive line, you know, they lost two first rounders in Akeem Mezidor and Reuben Bain, but the guys behind him, like Marquise Lightfoot, he didn't play a ton of snaps because he had two first rounders ahead of him. Marquise Lightfoot would have started, Mike, at most ACC programs at edge last season. So what do they do? He's going to be the left end starter. And then on the right, Damon Wilson from Missouri, 8.5 sacks last season, was the most coveted prospect in the portal at the edge spot. Miami signed him. They're loaded at linebacker in the secondary. And then at wide receiver, Malachi Toney, I've said it all summer, he's the best player in college football not named Jeremiah Smith. Now, outside of him, there were some questions at receiver. So what does Miami do? They bring Darian Mensah, a quarterback, his best friend with him, and Cooper Barkate, who had 1,000 yards last year at Duke. Vandrevious Jacob from South Carolina. They've got guys, man. And then Mark Fletcher, 1,000-yard running back. Jordan Lyle, Shamar Brown. Elijah Lawson at tight end. There's not a lot of questions here. And so for the AP voters and coaches poll as well, to have Miami at number 7 in the preseason, I don't think right now on paper there's 6 teams better than the Canes, especially when you consider what they've added this offseason to an already pretty darn good roster.
What are they, your cohorts, Chris Hummer and John Talty? I've always liked the job John Talty does. I'm not as familiar with Chris. They just did a whole thing on ranking the payrolls, basically, yep. which is again, that is so 2026 college football, right? That's literally what we're talking about. You can't avoid the money talk at some point. As much as I try to do it, it is a thing. So they have an article, or there's another piece out there. Hell, you might have written one. You've got a number of guys at CBS on the $40 million club. I forget, is Miami in the 40 or are they just below 40?
I think Miami is in the 40. Along
They're
with,
in the 40 with, yeah, with Texas, A&M, Texas. Florida. Notre Dame is in the 40. Notre Dame used to be cheap as hell. If Brian Kelly did one thing, I know people just, Brian Kelly's stock has never been lower. He got them to spend money on facilities and everything else that goes along with being a blue blood. And now Marcus Freeman gets the benefit of all of that. But they're in the $40 million club. Believe it or not, Texas Tech is not. They're in the $30-plus million club, which is where almost every SEC school is, not named Texas, Texas A&M. But clearly Miami spends, they've got themselves a sugar daddy or two, and they're spending, and the benefits are there. Do you find yourself now, when you're writing some of these articles, where you are talking more and more about the money that has now been so universal in the sport of big-time college football?
Of course. And a lot of head coaches I talk to, Mike, point me in the direction to their personnel and general manager staff. I mean, they general managers know the roster almost better than the head coach does, because those are the guys that fill out the two deep with, you know, portal evaluations and, hey, coach, here's a guy from so-and-so G6 program that we think would be a factor here. I mean, those are the guys that do these evaluations and do it in like an 8 to 10 day span before that portal opens, when you don't have a lot of time while coaches are preparing for CFP. I mean, look at Mario Cristobal last season. He had several 4 playoff games to prepare for while Miami was trying to figure out what the 2026 roster looked like. Meanwhile, 2025 season still going on. Joey McGuire has told me some of the same things at Texas Tech. He's kind of alluded to it being a version of speed dating. You don't have time to really, you know, evaluate these guys the way you'd like to, prep ranks versus transfer portal. So they're just trying to find the right fits. And, you know, Joey McGuire and Texas Tech have done a good job. He's told me this as well, that they're trying to find SEC level linemen, because they know to win the Big 12, it starts in the trenches. They've done a good job the last couple of years, and obviously Texas Tech's a team that in this CFP and NIL revenue share-driven era, the Red Raiders are doing a hell of a job.
David Bailey was every bit of an SEC lineman and then some. It'll be interesting to see if they can replace that D-line, which was so good. And that group alone cost, I think it was something like, I don't know, $12 million. It was up there. Yeah, it was up there. Teams that people are overlooking. It doesn't have to be a team outside the top 25. It could be a team ranked 17. I don't know. But maybe some teams that you feel are being shortchanged on the conversation and the expectations.
I'll give you one ranked team and one unranked team. The ranked team is Penn State, just outside the top 15. I think it's the most favorable slate in the Big Ten. Penn State could get to 10 wins and not be all that an elite team, because they're one of only two Big Ten teams this season that does not play Oregon, Ohio State, or Indiana during that 9-game conference slate. It's a yellow brick road for Matt Campbell in his first season. James Franklin would have loved a schedule like this his last couple of years in Happy Valley. I also think that, unlike a lot of these first-year coaches at other Power Four programs, there's roster continuity because Matt Campbell knows what that two deep is. 26, I think, players are from Iowa State. A lot of those guys are going to start. Rocco Beckett, quarterback, multi-year starter. Hanson at running back. Some of those guys on defense. And Penn State hired Danton Lynn, who I think did a good job last couple of years at USC as Lincoln Riley's DC. Obviously, Gary Patterson now the Trojans DC, but Penn State's a team that I think can get to 9 or 10 wins, being that CFP conversation. And then a team that's not ranked that I think will be ranked at season's end is Oklahoma State. The win total's at like 5.5. Okay. I'm pounding that as my favorite over the offseason. 70 new players, Eric Morris, head coach from North Texas. He's got a couple all Big 12 type playmakers on offense. Drew Mestemaker might be an early round pick. Caleb Hawkins at running back had 1,500 yards. There's a lot to like about Oklahoma State. And outside of Texas Tech and BYU, there's not a lot of elite tier teams in the Big 12. So Oklahoma State would not surprise me at all if they go from 1-11 to maybe 8-4, 9-3.
I think that'd be a great story. Things clearly stale under the mullet man, Mike Gundy. And it's such a, anybody who's ever been to Stillwater, it is a phenomenal place for college football. They are all in. They just haven't had the results. And Gundy got them very close. It seemed like they were knocking on the door a ton of times. He just couldn't break through. You got me thinking about Penn State's schedule. I don't see Ohio State. I don't see Michigan. And I don't see Oregon. Do I have that right?
And no Indiana. Yeah.
And no Indiana. No defending champion Indiana.
Yeah, Penn State and Wisconsin are the only teams in the Big Ten that do not play the Big Three top five preseason.
They do have Michigan. I beg your pardon. Yeah. They're at Michigan, which we don't know how good Michigan's going to be this year. But the other ones are off their skit. So somebody's looking out for Penn State and Indianapolis, man. That is a hell of a if you're going to pick a Big Ten schedule, that's the one I want right there.
When I evaluate these schedules every summer, I tend to look at, okay, where are the automatic losses for these teams outside the top 15? And I don't have one on Penn State's schedule right now. They could easily go 10-2, but then you have to win those seesaw games against USC and Washington for the CFP committee to respect you. Because if Penn State goes 10-2 and loses both games against ranked teams, there's a good chance that they're going to be on the outside looking in. But yeah, Matt Campbell's got a great situation right now, at least in year one with how this slate ended
quick
up.
Quick hitter before we hit the break, and we'll bring Josh Pate in on the other side. Who do you have winning the Big Ten?
Ooh, that's tough. Oregon right now. They're a top four seed for me.
Yeah. Once Dante Moore decided to come back, it's them at Ohio State, with all due respect to everybody else in that league.
I think Oregon's defense, too, is going to be one of the nation's best.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll talk about IU because some people think they were slighted. I know our next guest believes that as well. Josh Pate will join us on the other side. He is Brad Crawford. I am Mike Morgan. Back with more here on the other side of a quick timeout. All right, welcome back. And, boy, 9:30 sharp. You know what we call that? That's good producing. It's also the talent getting out on time, which we rarely do in life. Brad Crawford of CBS, Josh Pate of – I'm going to have to start – reading up on your entire bio, Josh. I just read a good piece on you, by the way, Bobby Barak of OutKick. And we've talked about this on this show with you in the past, kind of your lineage to getting to where you are. But since that we've had you on last, you are now with ESPN. You're also part of I don't want to call it a podcast. What's the Bussin' with the Boys? A podcast show? What are we calling that?
I still haven't really nailed down what we call anything that we do now. Since this whole video element. So a show, I guess.
Okay, show. Yeah. We don't know what we call this either. We've been doing it for 10, 11 years. So that makes sense. But no, congratulations on that. You know, Brad, of course, I'm sure you guys have crossed paths before. And it's good to just be able to chop it up with some guys that love the sport and will be covering it nationally all year long. So let me not just say the lead and then bury it. Tell us about the new adventure you have going on this year with ESPN.
Yeah, I appreciate the kind words. Appreciate you having me. It's been a little while. So
I know, but too long.
You look tan. You look well rested. But it goes for both of you, by the way.
Amen. Yeah.
All right. So let me give you the framework. Last December, we're in Atlanta, a day before SEC championship game. Will's there, Taylor's there, I'm there. We're doing the altcast for ESPN at the SEC championship game. So we met with ESPN. One of the most refreshing conversations ever, because it's one of those situations where a really big, powerful group of people sit down in front of you and say, permission to speak freely. What do you think about us? What do you think about the way we do things in college football? So I spoke freely. And Will and Taylor spoke freely. We met individually with them. One of the things I thought, and I've thought this for years and years and years, was clearly college football is the number two sport in the country. And clearly ESPN is the biggest, you know, sports media entity in the world. And I've always thought that they did great jobs broadcasting the games, but fell well short of fulfilling the needs, fulfilling the consumption needs of people like us Monday through Friday. Now, I was never thought there was any reason for that. There was just a blind spot for them. So I spoke my piece on that and a few other things. And then this idea, this offer got brought to us to do a Friday show live on campus every week during the season. And that's kind of them saying, all right, you ran your mouth. Now here you go. Here's the ball. Make it, run with it. Don't screw it up. So we're just trying not to screw it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that is awesome. And obviously you'll be going to some of the best venues each and every week because you guys get to pick it. You're not relegated to like following an announcing crew. You just go wherever the biggest game presumably is, which sometimes I'm sure you'll get into fights and arguments over that alone. Especially there's a couple weeks on the schedule where there's a few bangers on there. But I think some people will be curious about this. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on the industry side because we want to just hammer out college football talk, but do you still own your own content? And you brought that up in the article in the piece I saw. I know ESPN doesn't typically do that. McAfee's the exception of that. But what does Josh Pate own versus how much do you do what the rest of us do, which is work for the man?
Well, I vastly underestimated how much people cared about that because when we made the announcement, I never even went down that road. And then that's all the replies were. So answer is unequivocal yes. I still own everything. I would never from this point forward enter into a deal where, I mean, unless it's 9-10 figures, some stupid number like that, I'm giving away what I kind of fought to take ownership of to begin with. So anything that we do, anything I explore doing is sort of in addition to the bedrock, the core of what I do, which is 3 nights per week during the season, 2 nights per week outside the season, just our college football show. Because that's the only reason anyone would know who I am anyway. And so why would you ever deviate from that? It's just nice to have opportunities come along because that thing has been successful.
That's awesome. By the way, shout out to Victory Drive in Columbus, Georgia. You and I both got our start in that fine burgeoning metropolis. That is Columbus, GA.
Crawford, you ought to off air. You ought to get a story or two about Victory Drive. You'd love it down there.
Great. Pawn shop, used cars, strip club. Pawn shop, used cars, strip club.
I'm a Southern guy. You guys know that. Josh knows that. I'm here in Fayetteville, North Carolina, but I grew up in, you know, Charleston, the Low Country. Josh, I got to know, man, a lot to catch up on with you and me personally, but I want to know how married life's treating you, man, outside of college football and how Savannah's handling, like, Josh's glow up nationally and that sort of thing.
Yeah, she couldn't care less. Actually, what we're doing here is I am shoved in the corner of this room. There are boxes everywhere because we are in the middle of a move right now. So really, that's the main event on her plate. She may be aware the season's about to start. She could possibly be aware about the ESPN show, but really, it's just finally we're out of an apartment. Because like Brad knows this, I moved here in 2020 right before COVID happened. I never moved out of the apartment I moved into. I never, ever, ever moved until I got married, at which point you're just legally required. You can't be staying in an apartment anymore. You got to get out of here. So that's how she's been. It's been good, though, man. It's been a crazy couple of years because we got married last May.
Yeah.
I tell you one thing. I have made sure to journal everything the past 2 years because I'm pretty sure like 10 years down the road, otherwise I would not have even remembered 90% of this. So I got that going for me.
Sounds
great. That's fantastic. Yeah. She's an Alabama girl, right?
She is a Southern Miss girl, LSU girl, Jones Community College girl, Ole Miss girl, Alabama girl.
So she was in the portal quite a bit.
She was a portal mover, yes, but she was a contributor everywhere she went. So
of course, very nice. Before you jumped on here, we were talking a little bit about the poll, the AP poll that came out. If nothing else, it's talk show fodder for a couple weeks, and then we'll pay attention, and then the playoff poll comes out, and it's like the AP poll doesn't even exist. What I saw your comments on Indiana, like you're not going to fall into that bear trap again. I think we all fell into that bear trap a little bit. Like, 2024 is a really cute story, but new quarterback, new this, new that, and still 5 kids from JMU starting, like, that's not going to last. It's not going to have the shelf life. of some of the other teams were used to jumping onto the scene and being a true contender. So now in 2026, here we have it, Indiana. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 teams ahead of the Hoosiers, right? Am I doing that math right? I believe I am. What are we missing here?
You may not be missing anything. Just with what I went through last year, doubting them too much, my mentality is, if I'm going to be wrong this year, I'm going to be wrong believing in them too much, because I don't want to go through the inverse of that again. And I remember this time last year, I didn't think they were going to be bad. I certainly didn't think they were going to be a Final Four team, a national championship team. And the reason wasn't even just they're replacing people. I don't remember myself thinking they were downgrading at quarterback. I thought they may have even upgraded there. I just knew forever in my life, I have had it hardwired into my brain. The nucleus of a roster is built through recruiting. And therefore the nucleus of a roster, you can go back over the rolling 3 or 4 year recruiting averages, and they're the thresholds, you know, they're like the minimum baselines you need to meet to be a contender. And it's always, you need to be top 15, rolling 3 year average, top 12, whatever. And they were well outside of that. And that combined with, they weren't going to duck all the big boys. Like, they were going to go to Oregon. They were going to have to go to Penn State. And that's a preseason top five Penn State, not the Penn State it ended up being. I thought that's just finally there. They have some teeth on their schedule. They're on everyone's radar. There's no way that continues. They'll be a pretty good team. And then they weren't. They were the best team in the country. And so the reason they were able to defy all that, to me, still exists, because I almost view it as a formula instead of little Lego block pieces. And that formula is still there. That may be, I don't know how I would rank this. I may rank it the best head coach coordinator trio in the country right now. And they maintained it. So we were up there in the spring and I hadn't seen Josh Hoover do anything. I didn't watch him practice, but I asked Sig, what'd you think about him? What'd you see about him? And they had already gone through spring at that point. He just said, I think what we got, what we needed there. We got what we needed. And it was just that grin on the side of the face that made you say, all right, well, check that box for him. So I don't know, man. I would not be ranking him outside the top five, because I don't want to be the guy who has to look back on a ballot and say, even after all they showed me the previous year, I still doubted him. Because you know good and well someone in the top five is going to crash and burn. Mm-hmm. That will be the comparative analysis that folks do on your ballot in December.
It was the win at Oregon. Like the win at Oregon last year for me and so many others was like the wait a minute moment. This is a different Indiana. I know they made the CFP 2 years ago, but seeing that win last year after Mendoza threw the pick six and just a rebound from that and come back, last second comeback at Penn State, it was very impressive. And as Josh mentioned, from a coaching staff perspective, they've had continuity a lot of these elite programs don't have. Dan Lanning replaced both coordinators this offseason. That's an underrated, undersold storyline that we aren't talking about enough this summer. Mm-hmm. Like, how is Oregon going to look these first couple games with new blood, basically, at both play calling spots? So, but I'm with Josh. I think Indiana should be a preseason top five team. Not my number one team, but top five for sure.
Well, here's what I know about Indiana from a fan standpoint. We did one of these shows literally minutes after they won the national championship, and it was one of the most listened to. And I know the reason why, because I don't think there was a single Indiana fan that was just diehard on this particular podcast. I think it was because it gave everybody hope in a sport that was insanely predictable during the 14 playoff era. People look at Indiana, which was a laughingstock of college football for so many years, and they say, okay, Cignetti might be good, but he's not that good. Like, if they can do it in Bloomington, we can do it, insert city, college town, XYZ. That might be oversimplifying it, but I do think that's why Cignetti gets away with talking smack the whole time and during Big Ten media days, taking jabs at the SEC. Because at the end of the day, Cignetti and Indiana gives your particular program that probably hasn't won a national championship in the last 20, 30, 50 or ever years. And you're like, I like the story. They still buy in on Indiana.
Yeah. Here's the problem with it. Depending on how you view it, here may be the problem with it. There is a germ of validity to the concept that if Indiana was able to do it, any of us can do it. There's a layer of validity there. The problem is people don't really know what they're saying when they say that. They don't really bother to get into the weeds of how did Indiana do this? and how difficult the how is to duplicate. And I know good and well, as easy as it is and as exciting as it may be for a fan base to say, well, Indiana did it, man, any of us can do it. It chews the fingernails down to the nubs for coaches and administrators out there, because they know, hey, they think this, and there's no talking them off of this, and we're not going to pull that off. And we know we're not going to pull that off. And
right.
Dang it, Indiana. That's kind of the that's kind of the reaction from inside the walls of some of these buildings out there.
He's ruined it, Kirk Cinelli, that is, for all these mid-tier Power Four coaches that aren't going to win titles. You know, the blueprint's there, but yeah, can you replicate that blueprint? No.
The curve, 100%, Brad. The curve of coaches getting fired in short order just grew with what has been done at Indiana, because the excuses that coaches have had at other programs that historically have not been good could always say, well, look, what did the last five coaches do before I got here? You really want to go into this cycle where you just keep firing coaches? And now the AD and the boosters and the people that kind of push the buttons up behind the curtain for these programs can say, yeah, but Indiana did it. So mm-hmm. we should. And I agree with you, Josh. I don't think that's a great, you're going to get in a lot of trouble if you start thinking to yourself, well, you can do it, so I should do it. I just need to do what? Well, get five starters from my previous coach's program that was at the FCS level, and I just keep getting portal quarterbacks that play much better here than what they did there. And I'm one of the best offensive lines, and I never make mistakes. And if it's a 5-yard false start penalty, it's like, oh my God, we don't see that around here. That's a lot to ask. It's just not that easy. Like, the programs that have been winning 7-8 games for 100 years are probably still going to be winning 7-8 games even in the Cignetti era.
Yeah, so, and I also think about how that applies. Of course, it applies to, I'll just pick NC State out of a random sample size. Up until 5 minutes ago, North Carolina State would have told you, we're not elite, but we're superior to Indiana. Like, clearly we're superior to them. And I could copy paste a dozen other programs that would have said that to you as recently as 3 years ago. So they look at it that way. But now keep in mind, at the very, very top rung of the ladder, think about what this does to the perspective at USD. Think about what it does to the perspective at Texas Tech, at Texas. Think about how different the world is. And as a result, specifically at the latter two, at really all three that I just mentioned, but Texas and Texas Tech, there is a world, and it gets so out into like the dumbest waters imaginable, wherein one or both of those programs go 9 or 10 wins this year, but miss out on the playoff. And we're legitimately having that conversation in December. Conversation you never in a million years thought you would hear. Like, wait a second, Joey McGuire won 10 games and they won the league last year. And you're telling me you want him out? And people would look at you and say, yeah, this is not about building and, you know, looking ahead to a 3-year maximize it year. This is every single year we buy the roster, we put it on the field, and it's your job to be there every year. And if you don't, all we're thinking is, well, how much further could so-and-so have gone with this?
The modern day college football has to insert two phrases into their lexicon now: donor fatigue and return on investment.
Yeah,
that's what coaches tell me as much as anything. I can't keep going to the same guy and asking for more money, and then other boosters are saying, I've already given you this. You haven't gotten me what I want for the money. Everything's transactional. These folks don't always give money because they're just really nice human beings and they're philanthropic. That's rarely the case.
And it would help if we stopped extending coaches after 7-5, 8-4 finishes.
Yeah.
Like nobody's pining for your coach. So stop increasing the buyout to $50 to $60 million 5 to 6 years out. Let's just see how it is the first 2-3 seasons and see where this leash ends up.
Jimmy Sexton on line two wants to talk to you, Brad, about that concept. He's building an extra wing on his house based on those buyouts. We couldn't do a segment without talking about Alabama, right? First time in 18 years, not preseason top 10. They're preseason 13. Now, for a lot of people in Alabama land, that's a complete slap in the face and a spit on my shoes type of ranking. But then I was talking about this yesterday. If Alabama finished 8-4 and didn't sniff the playoff, I wouldn't be shocked. And if they went to the playoff and made it to the Final Four, I wouldn't be shocked. We still don't know who their quarterback is going to be. I wouldn't be shocked if he went with either one of those guys in week one. How do we feel about Alabama right now?
All right. I'm going to go watch them scrimmage Thursday. So I'm fascinated by what I can see because I have heard really, really conflicting things just over the past week from people I would trust. Like, there are people who have been through there and watched them practice. I think Aaron Taylor's one of them because he publicly said what he texted me, which was, this offensive line's night and day different. I love the hire of Adrian Clem. They're going to be able to run the ball this year. That's a serious unit. I had another couple of guys who similarly either played that position or coached that position who have been through there who said the same thing. But then you talk to people who watch them scrimmage, and it is very, very up and down. It's very much, I still got a ways to go here. Boy, this is going to be a work in progress. Boy, the ceiling potential of this personnel group is probably limited. So there's that. They've had injury at the tailback position, and the two guys you would probably most readily circle, EJ Crowell, the true freshman, and then A.K. Deer, the guy who had probably stood out the most in camp, are either hurt now or have been hurt and hadn't really practiced. And I just view it so much as conditional. A lot of times, if you wake up in the morning in the spring in the South and there may be severe weather, your meteorologist will say it's a very conditional threat today. So some bad stuff could happen, but all the parameters have to come together in the exact right formula for it to happen. And if it doesn't, it'll be nice today. Maybe a stray thunderstorm, but it'll be nice. That's kind of Alabama to me. It's kind of the most conditional contender in the country. And in the portal area, you're going to see a lot of that because rosters are so thin. But the one thing I cannot look away from is they are way better up front defensively. They've got one of the best secondaries in the country. Pure question at linebacker for me. But if they're the kind of team whose defense can buy them some runway early, and they already have a pretty workable early schedule, but if they can do that, and then let's say it ends up being Keelan Russell, and I just say his name because I think he has the highest ceiling, probably the more inconsistent guy through fall camp, but has the higher ceiling. But if it clicks for him and you get to the midpoint of the season, that defense bought you time, and then a star quarterback starts to emerge. Star quarterbacks, as you guys well know, can mask a lot of other inefficiencies. And that's why I hold reservation for Alabama. And luckily for people who are trying to predict their season, they're not LSU. They don't play multiple high caliber losable games early. So I want to check back in October with Alabama.
Brad?
I just need to see week two at Kentucky. I want to see what that week two SEC opener for the Tide looks like on the road in Lexington. I don't have UK making a bowl game this season, but they're going to be a much improved team. Spent a lot of money on that roster, especially on the O-line. And Kenny Minchie, I mean, maybe he plays well early and Will Stein continues this quarterback domino effect he showed the last couple of years at Oregon and it works out. But that SEC opener at Kentucky is one that I think we're overlooking a little bit. And for me, I still need to wait and see on Alabama. I'm somebody that has not had the Alabama Crimson Tide in the CFP the last 3 years, this time of year in the preseason. And, you know, I'm sticking to that. I think that there's still some questions at certain areas, especially wide receiver, that they did not address in the portal. Losing Horton was big. And obviously Ryan Coleman-Williams has some drop issues in his career and needs to get back to that big play guy we saw as a freshman.
One thing also about that wide receiver room, the one portal move they did make was getting Noah Rogers, who I believe was from NC State.
Yep.
And watching them practice in the spring, the day I was there at least, he was the standout. And then he promptly gets hurt towards the end of spring, and they expect to get him back at some point. But, you know, with that position, it's kind of one of those things where, all right, it's great that I get you back. What percentage of you am I getting back? But that wide receiver room, I think on that team, has the highest ceiling floor variance.
Yeah.
I mean, if everything worked out, if Ryan Coleman-Williams was, you know, his peak self, said Morgan's a five-star true freshman coming in, Noah Rogers, if you get him back healthy, Lotzier Brooks has recently practiced but has been hurt. If all those guys were to play to form, that could be a high-level receiver room. It could also end up bottom half of the league. Like, anything's in play.
Yeah. The fact that all three of us balked at the opportunity to say, of course they're in the playoff, it's Alabama, that tells you why Kalen DeBoer, no matter how many contract extensions, no matter what the buyout is, there's going to be a cloud over his head when you follow the GOAT saying, okay, this is good, but it's not good enough. I'm fascinated by Alabama. And I agree with you, Brad. Remember, Kentucky in week two last year gave Ole Miss a run for its money.
Yep.
That was a scary game for Ole Miss in Lexington. You don't get a chance to kind of lather up in week two. It's the one SEC game on the slate. I think that one will be fascinating. Final minutes, I want to talk obviously some SEC here. I thought it was in good fun, and you guys went back and forth. And let me just say this, Josh. Everybody had quarterback rankings wrong in the SEC last year. I mean everybody. So you had you took a lot of a slack. You had what, Lagway one, and then I mean I had Garrett Nussmeier one. Now I didn't know he was going to be hurt the whole year, but he clearly was a major disappointment. Lagway was beyond a disappointment. Lenore Sellers did not have the year people wanted to have. I'm trying, and all the guys that people thought were going to be the leaders in that position were not. So this year you came up with another top 10. You want to share maybe the highlights and kind of your rationale on how this year will be a little more predictable than last year, which was the bizarre world of SEC quarterback play.
Yeah, at least this year's safe because pretty much everyone has Trinidad Chambliss one or two. So if I go down, the whole ship goes down with me this year. I'm fine there. I put Arch at two. You know who I struggled with was Lenore Sellers. If you're trying to be predictive, instead of just this is a career resume ranking, and you try and do it like relative to what he has to work with, I could have had him as high as three, as low as seven. I'm high on Mateer, and that's kind of – I'm probably more on the extreme upside with Mateer, maybe I would think, than the field would be. I had him up there, trying to think off the top of my head. Gunnar Stockton was in there. And then
Marcel Reed.
Marcel Reed was the other one. I had a call from Lucci 5 nanoseconds. So I put Marcel at eight, but there was just not much separation. Because here's the one thing I did was I do believe Alabama's going to get good quarterback play. No matter which one of those guys wins that job, I do believe he'll get good quarterback play out of whichever guy starts. So I put the Alabama QB as a name in the sixth spot. And you can imagine the reaction that got.
Sure.
And then I put Marcel behind them. It's just a consistency thing for Marcel. It's where you got to be so careful in the modern highlight age, discerning highlight film from actual film. And Marcel Reed is one of those guys where there's the biggest detachment, maybe highlight film versus down in and down out film. And if those can just come closer, I don't even care if you shave off the high end stuff. If you bring the floor up, yeah, he's a top five quarterback in the league.
Where do you side on all this, Brad? I know you didn't come up with a top 10 list, but where do you – who's going to be good? Who's going to be disappointing? Reed.
I've got Marcel Reed in the mid-tier as well. I don't see him as a Heisman candidate. Four new offensive linemen in College Station. Lost Casey Concepcion. I know the wideout room is talented with Craver and some of those guys back. They got Isaiah Horton, obviously, from Bama. But, yeah, A&M's a team, and Marcel Reed specifically, where, you know, the highs with Marcel Reed was coming back to beat Notre Dame on the road. We saw his debut a few years ago when he had 100 yards rushing against LSU in College Station. And then the lows were like multiple first-half picks against South Carolina and falling behind by 28 points at home to an eight-loss team.
Yeah, I had him at Texas in the finale, and he did not look good at all. The moment just seemed too big for him. I know he got a little dinged up early in that game, but people forgot about the guy who was actually a Heisman candidate before the tailspin toward the end.
Yeah.
But it, like you said, Josh, if the floor raises and just maintain the highs, he could certainly have another very good season. You know, and then you have the newcomer, Byron Brown is fascinating to me. I want to see how it translates at the SEC level because the numbers he put up last year at UCF were phenomenal. We already talked about Minshew. I think it's going to be a very intriguing year of quarterback play. To that end, give me a couple of teams you think could actually have a chance at Atlanta that are not named Georgia, Texas, Ole Miss. Brad, we'll start with you.
Not name those three? Definitely LSU.
Not name those three. Okay, LSU.
Yeah, I've got
– we almost LSU made a whole segment without talking about Lane Kiffin and LSU. That would have been sacrilege, so thank you for saying that.
LSU and Oklahoma will be the two teams that I have there. I think Oklahoma will be very good on defense again, probably top five unit in the SEC, and John Mateer healthy. I mean, he was banged up the entire second half of last year, and it showed offensively when they were in quicksand and stale and everything down the stretch. So Oklahoma, LSU are two teams I think could challenge for Atlanta.
Those are the ones I go with. If I wanted to go way out to the fringes of believability, Tennessee right now. Tennessee, I think, is probably the team that has to be the most in touch with what its identity has to be in fall camp of any of these teams. There's no mystery. They got a pretty good 1-2 at wide receiver, but it's not a totally star-studded receiver room. They still got a quarterback competition going on where either guy's going to be green when he starts. Don't have a transcendent superstar tight end, but what they do have is O-line, and they do have a really good tailback room, and they've got a defense that I think can play good enough in year one under Jim Knowles to where they can shorten games, they can limit possessions, they can get ultra-physical with you, and they get Texas in there. They get Bama in there. Let's just say they win a couple of ugly games. Let's say they win in the manner OU found a way to win down the stretch last year. That's the kind of team that just could randomly be in Atlanta. And I look at it and say, that's mildly surprising. But you know what? Nothing shocks me these days.
You know what's so good about Tennessee in the way of predictability on the high side is that they always have a 1,000-yard rusher.
That's true.
Three straight years, three different dudes have run for 1K, and they've got the returner 1K this year. People think pass-happy offense. They run the ball as well as anybody in this league the last 3 years.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to like there. All right, as we wrap things up, Josh, you mentioned you kind of threw everybody a curveball because we keep hearing on the playoff side, is it going to be 12? Is it going to be 16? Is it going to be 24? You threw out the number 20. Any update on anything? Because they got to get together here in the next, couple of months and talk about this again. So where do we stand there? Brad, I'll have you chime in as well after. But Josh, give me the rationale behind 20.
Yeah, that came from not me looking for a story. I can promise you that. I was talking with people at the media executive level about some other stuff. And that just got floated to me. And I said, wait, I hadn't heard anything about that recently. They said, yeah, that's probably going to be presented to the committee next week. So I put it out there, didn't think another thing of it. And then that kind of became a pretty big story. It sounds like it didn't go anywhere because it sounds like it's basically, you can either call it SEC versus Big Ten, or you can call it ESPN versus Fox, however you want to frame that up. That sounds like a stalemate now, with the only variable being, do the people who allow Greg Sankey to take the stand he has taken right now continue to allow him to do that? Now, selfishly, I'm pulling for him in this equation because selfishly, I want to stick at 12 for a little while and see how this works out.
I want to keep conference championship game weekend, man. I grew up watching Georgia Dome games first weekend in December. SEC championship game was like a playoff game, so to speak, before the BCS and all of that. So I want to keep that. I do think we expand next couple of years at least to 16. I don't think the SEC would have moved to a 9-game conference schedule if we didn't see expansion coming.
I'm good with 16, even though you're out of my comfort zone. I used to be an 8 guy, and people thought I was nuts for saying 8 years ago. Then I grew into 12, and I'm willing to be flexible, like any married man has to be, to go to 16. But man, you start talking 24 and you have lost me. And I don't know many college football fans that are pounding the table said, we got to have 24. I don't know where these people are. I think
the dumbest thing, by the way, this could apply to either side. The dumbest thing that happens right now is fans of a team in a conference getting sucked into beating the drum of whichever media network owns the rights to that league.
Yeah,
they don't care about you. You shouldn't care about them. It's okay to be selfish. It's okay to just look in the mirror and say, self, what do I want here? How about I advocate for that instead of being a Wisconsin fan or being a South Carolina fan, thinking you just obligatory have to align with whichever media network owns your media rights.
Right. Right. Gordon Gekko would have loved what you just said. greed is good sometimes. I mean, that's capitalism at its finest. Josh, capitalism has been good to you. Congrats on all the newfound success. It's been too long since we've had you on last. I hope we'll get you on in the season, but I will not pester you, as many people have. So you're welcome when you decide it's time, but continued success. And tell people out there again how they can catch some of your content throughout the season.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, brother. Just search Josh Pate's College Football Show. That ESPN show will be Friday during the seasons, I think 2 Eastern. Check me on the time, though. But otherwise, just Josh Pate's College Football Show, wherever you search, whatever you search. It should be there. If it's not there, it's on me. It's not on you.
If it's not, we'll just give out your cell phone and people can track you down and find it, the content there. Yeah. Go find yourself a good twister here, Josh, if you can find one before the season starts, okay?
I appreciate you guys. Good to see you.
You got it. Josh Pate, ESPN, appreciate you joining us. Brad, man, I look forward to doing more of these with you, and always appreciate your work on CBS. Anything in particular you want to plug before you get out of here?
Hey, man, my preseason bowl projections are out in 48 hours. Been working a long time on it. 43 games. I'm projecting the playoff and the rest of the bowl game, Citrus Bowl, Gator Bowl, ReliQuest, all of that. So
very, very nice. Well, you got a big Gamecock helmet over your left shoulder. You want to tell me what bowl game they're going to?
They are going to a bowl game with a 7-5 type finish. Maybe Las Vegas. Interesting.
Maybe Vegas. Oh, Gamecock fans in Vegas. That's a good time right there. I've called a Vegas bowl or two. It's back when they played in the old Dumpy Stadium is when I did it.
The CFP title game is in Vegas this year as well.
That's right. That's right. That's one of the few NFL stadiums I've not seen. I hear it's unbelievable.
I haven't seen it.
Brad, thank you so much, man. We'll talk to you next week, okay?
Good to see you, man.
You got it. That does it for another installment of JC and Morgan College Football Forever. See you next Tuesday, everybody. So long.